I'm Alex Auerbach, and I'm a performance psychologist with experience working in the NBA, NFL, with elite military units, and Fortune 5 executives. I'm excited to bring you the Perform podcast, where we unlock and uncover the principles and practices of health and high performance for teams, individuals, and organizations so that you can be your best when it matters most. Super excited to be joined by JP Nurbon today. JP, how are you?
Man, I'm very good. Excited for this conversation.
Yeah, likewise. I'm going to spare you 45 minutes of talking just about your book, although you did write a book called The Culture System, which was all about helping people very pragmatically build a system to implement a culture. Let's just start big picture. Like, what is culture to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I always liked Daniel Coyle's definition around culture is what you do, you know, and those behaviors make it up. But I like to be a little bit more narrow or specific. And when we're talking about culture, I measure it in like two big ways. One is, you know, the relationships, the connections, you know, how much people feel connected to each other and to the purpose or the goal of the team. And then we also like to measure it through the behaviors, the standards, how are people consistently behaving, acting, responding when things are good and when things are bad and when leaders are present, when leaders aren't present. So I look at it from those two things, just how connected are people. And you could have teams that are like super connected and they're really good friends, but they're not high performing. But you could also have a place where, you know, people come in and maybe they work hard, but they like that connection. And thus I think the standards, you know, they slip over time. They lack, you know, the greatest motivation. There's only so high they can get. So I think the other thing I look at is within the culture is what's driving it. So, you know, you look at a collection of individuals, what are the standards, what are the relationships like, and who's driving that forward is really kind of how I assess or look at culture.
I like the inclusion of both dimensions. I think it's easy for people to get over-indexed on one side, right? You think about it as kind of like the way you feel when you come into work, and that might be more the relationship side, or you think about it as like the stuff we put up on the wall, and that might be more the standard side. I know for me, you know, I think about kind of value standards and norms, right? So what are the things we aspire to be? What does that look like as sort of a minimum viable expectation? And then what are the things we kind of like tolerate and expect to show up on a day-to-day basis? And then I also look at what you're talking about, which is sort of like the cohesion, general relationship vibe. I'm curious then, in the work you've done now, building cultures, helping other coaches, leaders think about building a system that resonates for them, what are some of the common challenges you've seen, and what have you seen work really well in the work you've done?
I think one of the greatest challenges, you know, would be first off the leadership journey itself. You know, I think there's, when it comes to culture, there's so many things that can pull us away from what's important, what we set out to do. I think we all, you know, kind of go into the season or go into the year with great aspirations, great visions, and then you lose a couple of games, you get some hard criticism from fans, you know, unexpected issues pop up, and all of a sudden you feel like, oh, my plan for this year to really connect this group, it's failed. And then you just kind of get caught up in the X's and O's. So I think the leadership journey itself is challenging. And I think outside of that, I think the other thing is that the culture is so dynamic. It's changing, not just from, you know, program to program or team to team, club to club, it's changing from year to year. And it's, you know, it changes drastically in a pro level. You know, you bring in a new player, middle of the year, that drastically can change the dynamics in the locker room. So I think the constant changing of the culture makes it really hard for anyone to say, hey, this is how you do it, you know, and like be really like clear. Whereas I feel like probably on the X's and O's and tactical stuff, you know, there's a little bit less variables at play there.
I think that's a really important point, and I want to spend a little bit of time on that, because this is something that I think people wrestle with a bit, which is sort of like, how much should you actually allow your culture to evolve, and how much should it or should it not change on a somewhat regular basis? And this gets true even down to the individual level, as some of the work I do with, you know, elite leaders and performers on their own values, it's kind of like, well, what if my values change? Or what if what we believe in changes? Like, is that okay? So for you, should culture evolve? And if so, how, why, when?
Yeah, I think it definitely evolves with us first as the leader, right? So I think we're all constantly trying as a leader to cast a vision for the program. We're discovering what's most important to us. And I think that also obviously changes with the context, the players that come in. You have to evolve to what it looks like for them. You know, it's so interesting. I just had a call earlier today with a high school coach, high level high school coach, who was, you know, exceptional team last year, one of the best in the country. And they lost 10 players. You know, they saw this huge turnover. And they had, but they had this great tradition within the program at their school. And how he responds to that is, you know, like, well, let's just stick to the system. Let's stick to how we do things. Let's pass the torch. And it'd be great to just continue to pass the torch of what it meant to play basketball at this school, you know, for the last few years. But it doesn't work that way, you know, because he has a whole new group of individuals that want to put their own stamp on that. And so it becomes, you know, this evolution of, okay, well, this is what we were about. And this is where our values were, this, and this. There were trust, care, and commitment. But now with this whole new squad, right, what does trust, care, commitment look like for them? And it's allowing them to partake in the conversation. And as I think Owen Eastwood actually has a great metaphor for it in his book, Belonging. He says, you know, the leader's casting the vision, you know, but the players are allowed to color it in. And so I think it's, you know, we might cast our vision differently from year to year. We might make some slight changes, but also the players aren't able to come in there and put their own stamp on it.
Yeah. Owen's obviously a great thinker in this space and someone who I really admire and respect too. And so that resonates for me, what you're talking about. And I think, you know, what I'm taking away and what I think is really important here is the flexibility to sort of like adapt and adjust. I think in the same way we talk about X's and O's, technical and tactical with players, right? Like you coach the players you have, not the players that you wish you had. You create the culture with the assets that you have, not with some pie in the sky dream that can or can't be realized. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't be aspirational. It just means you have to be somewhat grounded in the reality of the culture building.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one of my biggest fans, and I talk about this coach in my book, is a guy named Dave Brandt, who coached at Messiah College, which was a Division III soccer program in Pennsylvania. And they won an crazy amount of championships. And they had an incredible culture there at that level in that environment. And there's a lot of the great reasons for why they were able to be so successful. But, you know, he always came up with that idealistic vision of be the best team to play for, best soccer team to play for in the country. And, you know, I have no doubt that he's tried to carry some version of that as he's moved on to other colleges. And now he's at Bucknell University coaching soccer there. I have no doubt that he's carried that with him. But it for sure has changed when you're, you know, take over a program that's near the top of your division, at Division III, and then you move to some like bottom of the barrel, you know, like struggling Division I. Like, you know, it's going to, like you said, you have to kind of temper some of your expectations for sure.
I think it's, I want to talk about this coach for Messiah from the book. I know we're not supposed to get too deep into it, but I thought when I was reading it, I'm like, this is a really interesting example because this is a person who probably wouldn't make it into like the more popular sphere of knowledge around building this really great dynamic team, but has been like wildly successful basically by all standards of sport success. I'm going to ask you to do the impossible. Like, what is the core of what you think makes them special?
Intentionality. I really think I've worked with a lot of coaches, and a lot of the coaches I work with, there's something special and great about all of them, but there is a level of intentionality that very few coaches out there have at the level that Brandt has with, you know, at Messiah. I can check in with a coach in a one-on-one session. Yeah, things are good. And they'll bring up maybe a big issue that landed on their plate. right? They might, hey, like, what's the next thing we got to do? Like, we got a couple of things coming up here, a couple of games, a couple of tough ones. Okay, how can we plan for that, right? So you might have a bit of that. But some of these conversations I get to have with coaches, which is really awesome, Alex. Like, as a coach, would be like, so I had a conversation with so-and-so yesterday, and I'm not sure how it went. All right, let's unpack it, right? And so we unpack it, how it'll go, okay. All right, well, what, you know, what questions might you ask, or how much you follow up? And like, we get down into the nitty gritty, you know, and today I was breaking down with a, you know, pretty high level coach, the difference between curious and leading questions. And we spent maybe 25 minutes talking about and going through different examples and evaluating his performance and him getting mic'd up, you know, of just like, just on this one element of how he can be super intentional in his language to move from a question from asking players when he feels their effort is really poor, going, how do you think your effort is? When they already know that he has an answer to that, you know, it's a leading question. And now moving that to a curious question of like, hey, you know, what's going on with you guys today? Or what are you noticing about today's practice? Or, you know, is there anything, you know, just becoming more curious and how the effect that that can have on players. So when I look at Brandt, he has something, you know, in the situations, you know, why people become really successful and win the championships, there's a lot of that is circumstantial, but what he has is really still special. And you can't discredit that as a coach. He is super intentional. Everything he does, from his team meetings to organization of locker rooms to scheduling to way he recruits, is super well thought out and always getting better. It's not thought out the one time. It's like, okay, this is the way we did it last year. Now, how can we improve it? It's constantly reflecting and refining, you know, to optimize every aspect of the program and of your coaching.
I think that part of it is so important. The intentionality, being really thoughtful, considerate. I love the example you gave about the leading versus curious questions. I think this is a place that, in an effort to kind of like teach and instruct, we sort of do the rhetorical questioning because we know the answer we want to hear and what we think we should hear, but it undermines the real learning. It also hurts the relationship. Like, there's just a lot of elements of that I think are problematic. And so here's Brandt, who's sort of come up with a way to manage these sort of like typical coaching traps, I would say, and do it in a way that's allowed him to be really successful over the long term. I think one of the things we were talking about off air sort of feels connected to me here, which is the link between accountability and intentionality, right? So if you're going to be really purposeful in the way you do things, or the standards that you set, or what you believe is necessary for the culture, then you kind of have to hold people to that. Even if it's a little bit uncomfortable, or it involves one of your star players, and that might not be the way you want to do it. There's a lot of opportunities to sort of undermine culture. And it's one of the things, like, when I talk about it, it's sort of hard won and easily lost, right? It's really challenging to build a great culture. And it just takes one time of letting things go that it undermines everything that you've built. And so I'm imagining for Brandt, this is probably a place in addition to being intentional, that he spends a lot of time thinking about what he's built. I'm curious if you can just kind of unpack the role of accountability and culture building, and if you see the link between accountability and intentionality.
Yeah, and this is where everyone starts to slip, when they start to kind of, maybe you're trying to build a really great culture where it feels good, and you're, or you're trying to be more transformational. You want to have an impact on your athletes, is that, you know, we try to just remain really positive, really encouraging, trying to just kind of coax these behaviors along. And the reality is sometimes consequences are needed because they give us in life the pain that's necessary for us to change, that little bit of motivation. And now how we come about those consequences and those, that level of accountability, what that looks like is very contextual. You know, in some of this work that I do with coaches, I do have a few more logical type consequences approach and more restorative justice of type approach within teams. And we can unpack that if you want in a bit. But I think the big thing, whatever your approach is, do you first off have relationships with those individuals? Those have to be present, some sort of relationships where you've connected with them. And also, is the standard super clear? Or the next thing I look at. Okay, standard super clear. Have you also agreed upon what the accountability will look like? So what you, you know, everyone, you know, sets up core values and talks about common behaviors or, hey, what do we need to do this year to be successful or have a great experience, all these things. But then, okay, when we're falling short on those things, if we don't do those things, what's the natural consequences? Well, we're not going to be successful. We're going to fall short. Okay. So what do you need from us as leaders? How can we hold you accountable in a way that's going to be a work for you, all of you? And I mean, I'm not a big fan of get on the line and run and all that stuff like that. But if the players suggest that, it's not the worst thing in the world, as long as we're agreed, this is what's going to be our reminder. This is going to be our reset. This is what accountability is going to look like within a practice, within a game. And then off the court, I think, you know, or off the field, off the ice, you do need to get creative in how you hold players, you know, accountable in a way that is owned by everyone there. And it's restoring relationships, and it's not, you know, some tribunal every time some guy messes up. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And I love what you're saying here, because I think this is a place, at least in my experience in elite sport, this is a place of real fear, right? Like everyone sort of aspirationally talks about accountability really being important and you got to be a professional and on and on and on. But when push comes to shove and you actually have to hold someone accountable, people tend to become fearful that it's going to hurt their relationship, right? I'm going to do something or punish someone and now they're not going to like me and it's going to be harder to get something out of them in the future. And I think for many coaches and leaders, it leads to like a real aversion to doing the difficult work of holding people accountable. So I love this idea of getting the players basically to buy in and say, like, this is how you can do it, right? This is, I'm giving you the formula for holding me accountable. I think that's super effective. I also think the comment around accountability being a relationship builder and not necessarily something that detracts, I think is super impactful. I guess I'm wondering, like, you know, where do you think that fear comes from in terms of holding people accountable and the fear that's going to damage the relationship? And what have been some techniques you've used with the coaches you work with to help them feel differently about holding people accountable?
Yes, that is a really good question. So the fear is the fear of losing, I think, often. It's the fear of losing that relationship, the credibility, the credit that you've earned up with that player maybe. And it's also the fear of actually losing games, right? Like you hold certain players accountable that are your star players, you know, are you prepared to lose a game over it? And maybe there's a fear of losing your job as a result of that. So there is fear that drives that lack of accountability. When working with coaches that struggle with this, it's about, first off, I really think exploring the natural effects of their lack of accountability, their permissiveness, or their poor methods of accountability. And just first off, having an awareness of what they're currently doing and how it's actually hurting the relationship. And so one of the big things is when you measure culture, or even just the strength of a relationship, like if I don't really have a meaningful relationship, I don't have a really strong relationship with the athlete if there's no level of accountability, right? Like I don't, you know, like it's that truth of love. It's the Greg Popoviches of the world. These coaches that are really hard on their players, but are super relational, that it can give truth and love. So, but it's first off exploring first, you know, what is their current effects of the way they're holding them accountable. Secondly, it's unpacking and at least just having awareness of what the obstacles are for them. I would tell you some coaches, it's the fear of certain things. And some of them, it's just the lack of experience. You know, it's the lack of experience using different methods. So what the best thing you can do is agree on a few things as a coach that you're going to use, and you share them with your players and you try to get them to buy into. And so, for instance, some of these might be when a player is not meeting the standard, you might remind them of their effort, their attitude in a practice or game. But if they don't meet it, you might ask them to step off, say, hey, you know, you go reset yourself, but you've lost the opportunity to get better in this drill. Like this is something we use at like the, more the high school and collegiate level. It's just that practice is an opportunity to get better. It's a privilege, right? So it's just this high demanding rather than coming in and yelling and making them run. And you know, there's a lot of things we can unpack there about why that's probably not the most effective. But once again, whatever you have, it's trying to get the coach to actually share that with the players. And then honestly, it's about training that. And I just got, you know, had a call with another coach earlier today, and he's 2 weeks into the season, and he's realized I have just been complaining and getting on my top six guys, because after top six guys as a basketball team, we've got nothing. But I haven't held them really accountable. You know, he might, you know, some people might say, oh, he's getting on them, he's holding them accountable. He's not. He's not enforcing any consequence. They still allowed to play. They're still allowed to do the drill. They're doing everything that anybody else is. There's no consequences other than just having to hear him, you know, bitch and complain honestly about their attitude or their efforts, you know? So, I mean, he admitted it. And so we had to unpack that. And then just, it's about, okay, you're not going to be 100% successful the next week, but what are some clear ways, you know, let's see one or two moments where you do step up and hold them accountable. But before he leans into that, he's going to warn his players, hey, I've let some stuff slide. I'm going to step in, you know, that way they're not totally shocked. Well, okay, coach is coming in and just holding us accountable today. He hasn't done that all year. Like that can be unsettling for players as well too.
I think this is just such a rich part of the conversation, is how clear you are in the communication that you're offering. So it's not just here's a consequence. It's like, these are the things I'm going to start doing. Here's what we're agreeing to. Here are the changes we're going to make. Here's how this is going to be implemented. Here are the ways we think about practice. So there's a real transparency in the process that I think players and followers, generally speaking, can buy into around being held accountable. Like, you're kind of demystifying the consequence because you're saying, like, this is coming and here's what we're agreeing to. You've also done a nice job of making accountability really concrete, right? It's not this sort of like vague, or we're just going to hold you accountable. It's like, no, like, this is what's actually going to happen, right? You're not going to practice anymore, or this privilege is going to be removed, or we're going to do, you know, extra running, which I want to double back to the exercises punishment thing, because I think your perspective on this will be super interesting. And I know I have my own bias here. I don't think we've talked about it yet on the podcast, but it's one I want to unpack. But I guess, like, what are the pitfalls, or what are the common mistakes then people make when trying to implement this approach you're kind of describing, where it is really transparent and clear and behavioral?
They don't follow through. Like, simply, that's it. Like, they've got it. They get there and then they get in the moment. And I don't want practice to be disruptive, or they're kind of in the gray area. Yeah, their attitude stinks, but it's not like, it's not so clear. Like, you can say, like, you're 100% certain, you know, you don't have hard evidence of some, you know, everyone knows they're talking in the locker room negatively, but you don't have hard evidence that, you know, you haven't caught them in the act. You know, it's that when they're operating in the gray, oftentimes that can be the challenge. We make excuses for them. You know, we let them off the hook. Ah, they had a tough game yesterday. But all the meanwhile, they're not giving great effort, and, you know, they're getting nothing out of that practice. It's being disruptive, and we make excuses for them. And so, you know, I was reading this book called Dopamine Nation. It's nothing to do with coaching or leadership. It's all about addiction and stuff, but it's written by this counselor or a psychiatrist, and it's a phenomenal book, but she has this line there: empathy without accountability, which she blames in the mental health world, that this empathy without accountability is one of the biggest, you know, failures of the healthcare system, especially in psychiatry, because there's just a lot of this empathy. And she says empathy without accountability is a short-sighted attempt to relieve suffering. And I think that's it, right? So we're like, you know, I don't want to get on today, but at the end of the day, not holding the player accountable is going to hurt them. It's going to hurt the team in the long run, but the coaches freeze up. They don't want to lean into that moment. The fear takes over. And they just don't follow through on it. And so that's where the coaching of the coaches comes in. You know, it's just constantly reviewing. And so often a coach will hop on a call with me, or they'll just be talking to their assistant coaches or staff. And what are we doing? We're complaining about the player's behavior. Did you see so-and-so today's practice? Yeah, it was horrible. And nobody did anything. You know, and I think that's one of the biggest pitfalls.
I think it's super important just to not be inert in these moments, right? So, like, there is always an option to do nothing. And that choice over time kind of compounds into people learning, like, they can get away with things. And I think that's the part where then, you know, in my experience, we end up down this kind of slippery slope, right? Where we don't address it once or twice or three times or 10 times. And then 3 months down the line, we're wondering why Johnny is really difficult to work with. Well, like Johnny is just being a normal person, kind of like progressively pushing toward minimum viable effort. And we haven't done anything to correct it. And so here we are trying to now manage that. So I super appreciate this part of the conversation, because I think you're giving really pragmatic advice and structure for people thinking about like, okay, what could I do to make my culture better? And so I want to turn to the exercise piece of this, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Give me your thoughts. Give me your first take. Like, should people use exercise as a form of accountability, discipline? Why or why not?
I hope you disagree, right? Like, I just like disagreements, but I don't know if you will. But for me, I'm really against it. I've used it for so long, and I'm against it for a few reasons. One is I look at like cultures around exercise and fitness and motivation. And one of the best cultures and exercise and fitness, whether you agree with their training methodology or not, is CrossFit, right? Like CrossFit creates, they don't even have like, it's not even, I guess there's competitions, but like when you show up in a CrossFit gym, you know, it's just the focus is supposed to be just on you doing your best, but you can't help but, you know, look across the other person. But here, I think what's interesting about CrossFit is people show up and they just get absolutely destroyed in these workouts, and they like it. They enjoy it. And it surprises them. And it's probably because a lot of, I think we do this training psychologically for years where it's like, oh, you're misbehaving, do the lap. You know, you're misbehaving, take 10 pushups. You know, like you're misbehaving, get on the line. Like it becomes so that all of a sudden that we see exercise as this like, and conditioning as a punishment and a consequence. And so we like to flip it on its head. So when it comes to enforcing consequences, we say, rather than you doing sprints because you're not working hard, it's you step off, man. You don't value currently the opportunity to get better in this drill. You've lost the privilege, right? So it comes back to, like, people use these cliches, like it's a get to, not a got to. And that's great. But do you reinforce that, right? Like, hey, you get to come in here and work hard. You don't want to work hard? All right, that's fine. You can step off, right? So we try to reinforce it that way. Also, when we do, like one of the things my coaches love to do that I work with is just a simple one. Is just, we call it the mental toughness conditioner at the end of practice. It's just a simple one where you put everybody's on the line. You can do a lot of different ones, but the most simplest way is everybody goes like a down and back sprint on the field or on the court or on the ice. And you know, whoever's last is out, but they're out and they're supposed to be there on the sideline cheering. And you just see who can last, you know, and you blow the whistle, and I'm telling you, every time we do it, there's a few players that don't give 100% effort that first few times. They get out early and then they're regretting it. You know, like you're trying to reverse psychology, is that the winner stays, the winner is getting the benefit. And you do that a few times with your team, and eventually you'll get guys that be like, hey coach, can I keep doing a bit of running here? Cause I need that, you know, I need to stay in shape, you know? So we're always trying to flip it on its head. But I think at the end of the day, that physical stuff is very fear-based, and we want to move away from fear-based type of stuff.
I'm not going to disagree with you on this one. So I might be intellectually capable of arguing the opposite, but I don't think from a place of moral standing and responsibility that I can argue the opposite. I mean, I think, you know, it's just been kind of like part and parcel of sport culture for so long. But at its core, like, we're basically just teaching people to have an aversive experience to exercise, which is like the fundamental thing we're trying to get people to do in sport, right? Is like give effort. And so it's sort of like the antithesis of what you are hoping for, right? And like, I actually think that, and there's no data to back me up on this, but I bet we could run the study. Like, the more you do exercise as punishment, the less effort you're going to get in practice, because people will have learned that exercise is bad, right? And physical exertion is bad. Like, that's the core kind of very classical behavioral link here. And so it's like, I wish I could argue against you. But it's interesting to hear kind of some of the ways you flipped it and made like effort valuable. And a couple of weeks ago, I had on the podcast, Dr. Michael Inslicht, a professor here in Toronto, who's done a lot of research on teaching people to value effort for its own sake. And I think you found a really creative way to kind of do that, where making the persistence and giving good effort in this activity is really meaningful. And you've also found a way to send a really good cultural message, which is that like the effort is what's rewarded.
Yeah. And that is honestly one of the most powerful things that you can give your players. I shared this, you know, a positive story. And I know this may not seem like, hopefully people can make the connection, but I remember when I was in sixth grade, young kid, and my parents said, yeah, you got to get A's and B's, right? Because we're, you know, we have a big family and they had to work a couple jobs to send me to this private school, get this education in the area. So you got to get A's and B's or else you cannot play sports. So I remember in sixth grade, you know, I get this couple bad grades and I like a C, and my parents pull me off the basketball team and the coach is distraught. The team's distraught. It's the big game and we lose the big game because JP, the star, is not there. Right. And my parents just didn't yell about it. They didn't complain. They just said, hey, you lost the opportunity to play. Right. And I had to get my grades up, got to go back and play. And then this happened again in seventh grade. Like I was playing football as a star quarterback and I get an F in Latin and they pull me off the team again. Now, my mother still had empathy. She sat there, she built flashcards, she taught me how to study, but she held the standard. And I love telling this story to parents and coaches because I never had an issue with grades after that. I got A's and B's all through high school, but that's not the power of the story. The power of the story is not my parents didn't have to worry about my grades anymore and they won. It wasn't a struggle for the next 5 years. That is obviously a positive, right? The real positive is that for the rest of my life, I valued the sport. I truly believe I made it onto a Division I team roster, not because I was talented, second shortest guy at University of South Carolina, even at 6'3", played an amazing team. You know, we beat Florida twice the year they won the national championship, or the first year they won it. I mean, just an amazing squad. I made it there through this like inner drive. But like, I always loved the sport, but all of a sudden, like, I always felt like it was a get to, like I had to work to get it, and it changed my mentality. And so when we're looking to like try to really build into intrinsic motivation, like I feel like intrinsic motivation is this thing in the air. Like we're like, how do we tap into it? Like, cause if you try to get into it and you're trying to tap into intrinsic motivation, you feel like you're extrinsically trying to motivate them, right? Like it's just by naturally us getting involved. But this evoked in me such a powerful intrinsic motivation. And I've seen that within my coaching and other coaches using that type of kind of, you know, consequences are like a loss of privilege, you know, and when they're done the right way.
I love the stories and I appreciate the link here to intrinsic motivation. And I think you might not be giving yourself enough credit, right? I do think there are other things you've talked about today and other things that are part of the work that you've done that, yeah, they're outside environmental influences, I guess is how I would think about it. But they do lead to people intrinsically being motivated to do things. And I'm a big believer, you know, that the environment has a huge impact on our overall behavior. And so I think part of structuring a good culture, part of being a good coach is crafting an environment that people can come into and find their own unique motivation for being excellent here. And so that's giving them enough freedom to have some control and autonomy over their, you know, how they do things. That's building practice so they have experiences of success. That's, you know, you talked about interpersonal relationships. That's creating a sense of relatedness and camaraderie in the locker room. Like these are all things that I think coaches can do with a well-crafted culture.
Yeah. And to tie back to your physical conditioning, when I make you run because you're not working hard, it feels very much to you as if I have taken away your autonomy. It's like, I'm doing this to you. But in the way that we try to enforce consequences from a privilege standpoint, we're emphasizing you have a choice. Hey, you want to get back in, you can start working hard. Like sometimes it's just, hey, as soon as you're ready to start working hard, you can get back in. As soon as you're ready, like you go reset. And sometimes that people need that ability to reset. But yes, you're trying to always respect the individual's autonomy. That's a huge, huge aspect. You know, we talked about, you know, having that vision, that shared purpose, that obviously it's bigger than themselves. Like that, those are other huge things within culture. I think at the end of the day, like, right, like you've nailed on the head, which is that that culture, the environment that we create should foster highly intrinsically motivated individuals. And anything that I do that prevents them, and I think Daniel Pink does this so well in Drive, he's like, sometimes the leader just needs to get out of the way. Like, we do more to demotivate than we do to motivate, you know, even like all the, you know, he says all the carrots and sticks, right? So I think that's really what we need to be focusing on for sure.
I am mindful of our time together. And so I want to find a couple of things we can leave people with if they want to increase their intrinsic motivation in their athletes, if they want to improve their culture tomorrow. So you're walking in, I'm going to ask you another hard one. You walk into a new building, like, what are the first things you're looking for to get a sense of where the culture is? And what are some small things you'd recommend people start thinking about if they want to make their culture even better?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think where you start has to be some great questions and being really inquisitive. If you had asked me this 10 years ago, I'd say you got to walk in with a plan. You got to know how you're going to do it. But like, that's like, you can't know the plan. You can't have an idea until you really understand the people. Culture is not like building a house. I equate it more like, you know, you got the blueprint and you go out and you lay it out, you know, you bulldoze and just build. It is more like gardening, is what I equate it to. You have to cultivate what is already good. If you come in there, you know, like if you come in there, you're just like, all right, this is the new way. Like, there's already some good things going on there. People are going to get pretty offended at times, right? So it's what's already going there and noticing that and nurturing that. And then, yeah, you're pulling some of the bad out. So I think sitting down and having conversations with athletes, with people around the team, all the stakeholders, you know, what do they enjoy about being here? What don't they enjoy? What's working? What's not working? If you were me, what's one thing you would do differently? If, you know, if you're the head coach, if I'm coming in as a consultant role, like I have a wide range of questions, but, you know, I just like, hey, you know, what's the biggest thing that we need to address? But you're really trying to get and identify, you know, what people enjoy, why they're there, why do they show up, you know, how motivated are they to show up every day? You know, just even having people put numbers on that. So that obviously their insights into the team and the program is really important, as well as just connecting with people as people. Like if you could just start with that to just actually get to know who they are off the field, off the ice, off the court, wherever it is, just if you could start there, you know, and then you could start digging into the program. The other thing is, if you want to start, you know, with some standards, rather than having the big summit where you lay down the 20 different standards that for your program that you got to be successful, just start with this simple question that you can ask, ask your players, and you can ask in a separate meeting your coaching staff. It's just, hey, what do you need from me for us to be successful, for you to be successful? Give me 3 to 5 things and give them time with that. Prepare them for that. Maybe have them break them into a group, have them discuss that as a team or as a coaching staff. What do you need for me to be successful? And after they shared that, then you got to share your things. But first off, understand, listen, and take on their things. And you'll probably be encouraged by them. A lot of times players will say, hey, we do need you to hold us accountable. We do need you to encourage us, those type of things. But then it's where you kind of come in and say, hey, these are the, you know, 3-4 things that I really need to operate a good program. And we call those non-negotiables. You know, Pete Carroll has them. You know, John Wooden has them. You know, we've looked at other people outside of sports. They use non-negotiables. Just don't need to have 20 different standards, just a few things. So those would be some kind of the big rocks, I think, early on, is just getting a few things rather than 20 things that can move the culture forward and start to build those relationships.
That's brilliant, because I think this is a place where so much is over-engineered. We try to just like rule our way, you know, literally into the culture we want with a 20-page rule book. And the best coaches I've been around, including, you know, several time national championship coaches, have like 1 page of 5 rules, right? Or 7 things that they believe in. And that's kind of it. And I think it speaks to a real level of mastery as a coach. But I think it also speaks to like real clarity on what you will and won't tolerate. And I think it's that's a brilliant place to start, and would encourage kind of any leader to really push into like, how do you narrow, right? How do you get to that list of 5 to 10, whatever the magic number is for you, things that you just absolutely will not budge on, because it becomes a lot easier to hold people accountable to 5 things than 50 things. And because there's value in the players knowing what those 5 things are and all those things. The other thing that really resonates for me is the idea that players actually want to be held accountable, right? Players want the truth. Players want honesty. They want to be coached. They want to be led. And sometimes we forget that, because we're worried about, you know, hurting the relationship somehow. And so I think, you know, to me, one of the things I'm walking away with this conversation from is just how you can leverage these relationships and create real depth, in these relationships to bring about the culture that you want. It doesn't have to be an either or, it can be a both and. You can have a really deep relationship and hold someone accountable.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the genius of the and. And you know, I think it's those narrowing, it's just, it scares me. Some of these coaches, you know, they'll hand you like, oh, here, let me send you my 20-page culture or program document. You're like, all right, how do we whittle this down? They're like, well, if I don't tell them that they cannot eat on the bus, then how do they know that they can't eat on the bus? I'm like, like, just like they want to get into these super narrow, you know, little pointed, you know, rules. It's like they want to ask everything about every aspect of the program. And it's like, you got to just accept the fact that most people pretty much know how they should act most of the time. Like, it's a lot of like stuff is just common sense. And so I try to remind coaches that like, they know how to act most of the time, but just really focusing on the 3 things that I always say, what really sets you off and what really annoys you as a coach. For me, it's like being on time. If you're late, it drives me crazy. Complaining, It's I think it eats away at the culture very fast. And then listening, I can't effectively coach or teach or lead a meeting if people don't listen, and we can't have conversations amongst the team if people don't listen. So those would be my big 3. Like, outside of that, I think I can work and we can strive for everything else, but those I would never sacrifice.
JP, this has been awesome. Where can people find you, follow you, learn more about your work and what you're up to?
Yeah, tocculture.com is the website. Email's JP Nerbin, N-E-R-B-U-N at tocculture.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm not really super active there. A bit of a digital minimalist in many ways. But yeah, in my book, The Culture System, A Proven Process for Creating an Extraordinary Team Culture, it's on Amazon, it's on Audible, iBooks. So you can get it anywhere.
Awesome. This was wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to have you back and kind of keep unpacking your work around culture as we go. I think this is such an important area and topic for all coaches and leaders to be thinking about. We're super grateful for the time. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it was a fun conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Perform Podcast, where we unlock and uncover the principles and practices of health and high performance for individuals, teams, and organizations. Until next time, thanks for joining.